Let's start. Okay, so I'd like to start with discussion of the theory of cosmological perturbations. And I guess as I indicated at the beginning of the entire lecture series, the theory of cosmological perturbations is the backbone of modern cosmology, no matter what the theory of the early universe would end up being. Whether it's string theory, quantum gravity, conventional inflation, you'll essentially use the same formalism. So what we want to do is we want to connect the data with the fundamental theory. Through the study of gravity coupled to whatever the matter theory is. And since the data shows that today the universe is homogeneous and isotropic up to small fluctuations, and we expect the small fluctuations to be growing as a function of time, we therefore can assume, we can trust, that a perturbative treatment will be a very good approximation. So we really want to make the connection between the fundamental theory and the data using cosmological fluctuations. So what I want to do is I want to first discuss the Newtonian theory of cosmological fluctuations. And the main reason for doing this is to develop the physical intuition for how fluctuations grow, what are the structure of the equations, what are the effects that one has to consider. Then, so the Newtonian theory is not valid on scales that we are interested in the early universe. And I'll also show that the limiting scale is typically the Hubble radius. Scales smaller than the Hubble radius, you might be able to trust the Newtonian theory. Scales larger than the Hubble radius, you definitely never can trust the perturbation theory. You can never trust doing quantum field theory in curved space-time. And you never can trust any other perturbed matter theory on a fixed, unperturbed background. It will always be crucial to include the perturbations of the background on scales larger than Hubble radius. And so for that you need the relativistic theory of cosmological perturbations. And again, I will first discuss classical theory. But at the perturbative level, once we know the perturbations, if we know the action, we can quantize the action to quadratic order, and we can do the quantum theory of cosmological fluctuations. So the difficult thing is to gain the physical intuition, to develop and simplify the classical relativistic theory. It will turn out that the quantum theory of cosmological perturbations is completely straightforward and doesn't take much time once we've developed these two. So these two will take a crucial amount of time. So today has been a busy day, and so I'll kind of gauge when the audience looks to be fading, and then we can resume in the next group. So I don't know how far I'll get, but well, it's depend on questions. So let me start with the Newtonian theory. And so what I want to do is I want to start with the preview. So let's take one direction in space, and let's imagine that the energy density starts off almost uniform but with a small perturbation. So now, in this situation, the Newtonian gravitational force is stronger in direction towards the initial overdensity. Drawing arrows is the Newtonian gravitational force. And so you let the system evolve for a short amount of time. And after that, the density profile will look something like this. So we are using Newtonian gravity, which says that the density contrast will have an acceleration, which is given by Newton's gravitational constant, times the initial density contrast. So this is the equation that will describe the growth of cosmological perturbations if we perturb about flat space-time, Minkowski space-time. What we are doing here is we are doing something inconsistent, because if we have matter, then we don't have Minkowski spacetime. I'll come back to that in a minute. So what you should expect is you should expect exponential instability. Flat space-time is unstable to the development of gravitational perturbations. So now let's look at what happens if we perturb not about Minkowski space, but about an expanding universe, figure of a walk expanding universe. Then what will happen is that this effect will still be there, the gravitational attraction, but at the same time, matter is expanding. So the net effect of this is to add a friction term to this equation. A friction term whose magnitude will be proportional to the rate at which space is expanding, h. So therefore, the exponential instability will be damped, and what you will get is power law instability. So a spatially flat universe is unstable to the development of gravitational perturbations. You should expect power law instabilities. So that's a preview.
That's still consistent.
That's consistent. That I can develop in a consistent way at the classical level. And you'll see how that works.
But that differential equation seems to have an exponential solution, not a power law. No?
No. This one has power law, not exponential. Because if you make an exponential answer, you can either get these two terms to cancel or these terms to cancel. No. Just think about what the equation means. It's an equation of a harmonic oscillator with friction.
Yeah.
So, you get power. That's a harmonic oscillator with an unstable potential. Okay. So now what we would like to find out is how does the power that describes this instability depend on the background cosmology? How does it depend on length scale? It turns out that there are competing effects due to pressure, which render small-scale perturbations stable. So now the second preliminary I want to do is I want to discuss how we characterize perturbations. So here what I want to do is I want to introduce you to the jargon which you'll find in all cosmology papers. Power spectrum, scale invariance, what does that mean? So, space-time diagram. I'm doing Newtonian theory, so I'm considering the late-time universe, the Hubble radius. In a late-time universe, fixed co-moving scales are entering the Hubble radius, so physical length, time, this is fixed co-moving scales, K1, labeled by wave numbers K. Okay. So
you just had it on the same speed.
That's just physical distance which I'm talking, not co-moving distance. Okay, so we are interested in density fluctuations. So if I call epsilon of x and t the density, then I have delta epsilon of x and t. That's the density perturbation. What I can do is I can take the density perturbation and I can Fourier expand it. And the reason why we work in Fourier space in the theory of cosmological perturbations, or when you have perturbations, we linearize equations. All Fourier modes evolve independently. Therefore, we have ordinary differential equations if you work in Fourier space. So therefore, we work in Fourier space. So, and instead of delta epsilon, what we are very often interested in is the relative density fluctuations, which I call delta sub epsilon. This is the background energy density, the energy density perturbation.
Which might also be a function of
t. It's a function of x and t. That's been done explicitly.
No, I'm in epsilon.
Epsilon is a function of t. Let's put a zero in to make it clear that by that I mean the background.
Well, is there any exceptional cases where even if you're not assuming linearity, that you can do some kind of expansion?
Well, you can always expand, but if you want to, if you include nonlinear effects, then you have mode-mode coupling. That's, for example, in back reaction, that becomes important.
So in that case,
so it's like you are using mode-mode coupling to get your baryogenesis.
When we write just epsilon, we mean background density, and we'll put the perturbation on top of it.
This is a background density.
Okay.
Epsilon.
Okay.
That's homogeneous.
That's homogeneous. We are expanding about a Friedman universe. There's a homogeneous isotropic universe. That's what we see today. Okay. So. So now we can introduce the first symbol. We can calculate the power spectrum of the density fluctuation. And this is simply defined to be k cubed delta epsilon of k squared. The Fourier amplitude square multiplied by k cubed. K cubed is the phase space volume of modes with wave length larger than than the wavelength corresponding to k. So what we are doing when we multiply the square of the Fourier amplitude by k cubed is we are constructing a variable which is relevant in position space. Because if we imagine that we have a sphere of radius k inverse, and we ask what is the root mean square density fluctuation in this sphere, then this quantity, the root mean square density fluctuation, the root mean square mass fluctuation, in this sphere, we'll get contributions from all Fourier modes. And if you take wavelengths smaller than the wavelength k inverse, then these fluctuations will average out in this sphere, will average to zero in this sphere. So it's only long wavelength modes that contribute to the root mean square mass fluctuation in the sphere. And the phase space of these infrared modes is exactly k cubed. So therefore, the physical meaning of this quantity is actually a position space. Anyway, that's the definition, power spectrum, of delta epsilon. So now, there's also another quantity, which is phi of x and t. And this small phi of x and t will be the Newtonian gravitational function, potential. So in Newtonian theory, we have matter, and gravity is described by a Newtonian potential, gravitational potential. And we can define the power spectrum of phi as well. We define it as k cubed delta phi of k. Where this delta phi of k, that's the analogous quantity to here. It's the relative It's the Fourier mode in the expansion of the Newtonian potential. So this is the power spectrum. This is going to be not the relative
perturbation.
This is going
to be fine for you here.
Okay. So now, what I did, if I remember correctly, in the lectures on inflation, is I defined scale invariance. A scale invariant spectrum of mass fluctuations. I define this as in position space by saying that I have a scale invariant spectrum of fluctuations if I evaluate delta m of m of k, the quantity I illustrated here, the position space quantity. If I calculate this at the time when this mode enters the Hubble radius, so I fix my mode k, this mode k, it enters the Hubble radius at this time, th of k. If this quantity is independent of k, that's the definition of scale invariance. And more generally, I can, if it is not scale invariant, I can always characterize it, at least over a small range of k values, as a power. And this index here is defined as the index of, as the spectral index. That's defined, so this relationship defines n, and so you see that n equals 1 is scale invariant. And inflation predicts n equals 0.97, very close to n equals 1. So now what I want to do is I want to relate this definition of scale invariance is something which you can measure if you do a calculation at a fixed time.
So this delta n over n is related somehow to p epsilon of k, right?
That's right. That's right. It's related to p epsilon of k. And so you see in particular that see, this is kind of a strange definition for someone who does a calculation. Because if you do a calculation, you start at an initial time, you want to evaluate to some finite time, and then you want to evaluate quantities on different wavelengths at the same time. So you want to translate the definition of scale invariance to something that's more simple to use. Now, to make this translation, I will have to use something which I will derive subsequently. I will have to use the growth rate of mass fluctuations. I will use the fact that at late times, delta m over m grows proportional to t to the 2/3. So I will use this. So now with this knowledge, I can translate this statement into a statement about delta m over m at a fixed time. So I can write delta m over m kt, that's equal to t divided by t a to k, two-thirds, delta m over m k t a to k. Using this relation. So now th of k, that's given by Hubble radius Crossman, and I just want to write down this as a final equation before giving you the final answer. Hubble radius Crossman means h inverse Hubble radius in physical units, this is a physical quantity, is equal to physical wavelength, which is a of th of k times wavelength k inverse.
When you say physical, you mean physical, everything measured with respect to the background.
Right. And physical h in a in our late universe, power law expanding, h inverse is simply t. So this allows me to relate in a matter-dominated or in a radiation-dominated universe th of k to k, found that relation. And using this, so now I'll skip two lines of algebra. You find that delta epsilon of k and t is proportional to k to the square, k to the n, and delta phi of k and t is proportional to k to the minus 4 plus n. You multiply by k cubed, multiply by k cubed, get n plus 3. And therefore you find that scale invariance is equivalent to the statement that the power spectrum of phi evaluated at a fixed time is proportional to n minus 1, k to the n minus 1. For a scale invariant spectrum, n is equal to 1, and therefore this quantity is independent of k. So it's not in Fourier space, it's not the power spectrum of the density fluctuations, which is independent of k, but the power spectrum of the Newtonian gravitational fluctuation. And therefore, in the relativistic theory, it's going to be the power spectrum of the relativistic gravitational potential. Scale invariance means that that quantity is going to be independent of k. So this introduces you to the notation that is used in all cosmology papers. So power spectrum depends on which quantity we use and what the scale invariance means. And scale invariant is a statement that the power spectrum of the gravitational potential is independent of k when measured at a fixed time. Okay. So now what I want to do is I want to start deriving this relation. So I'll now do Newtonian perturbations about
Professor, I'm a little confused. You wrote earlier that P sub 5k was, we were dealing earlier with P sub 5k as the power spectrum of phi. But here we've written down delta phi. Are we talking about perturbations of phi now?
In here?
Yes.
But see, phi is my Newtonian gravitational potential.
Yes.
So delta phi is just its perturbation.
Okay.
Delta phi is a perturbation in the gravitational potential.
Okay.
So that's this one. Is that?
Okay.
I'm happy.
Yes.
In your definition of the power spectrum, isn't there really either a sort of delta function of k or a volume of a box that's been left out somewhere along the way in the definition?
No.
Not at the very end, but in the definition of the Fourier component of the square you took. I think there's something like the volume of the large box in that.
You can check that by dimensionals.
Yeah, that's what I was looking at.
That I couldn't get straight on this spot. There are different conventions in the literature about how to deal with this, with whether to include a specific volume factor in front of the integral or deal with quantities which have a different dimensionality.
Yeah.
So whichever book you read, you always have to check which conventions.
So I think if you write the power spectrum is fine, but if you want to think of it literally as the square of some Fourier model, then
yeah,
you have a dimensional mismatch.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so now we want to do Newtonian fluctuations about the impulse space. So I can erase all of this. So matter is being described by a trophic fluid. It's being described by energy density. Pressure. Velocity. Entropy density. So classical perfect fluid matter, and then gravity is being described by the Newtonian gravitational potential. So these are the degrees of freedom which we are working with. And the equations are the equations of hydrodynamics. So the first equation is the continuity equation. Conservation of matter. And then there's a force equation, which says that the acceleration what I'm writing here is a total time, this is a partial time derivative, this is the total time derivative of the velocity, so that's the acceleration, it's the A in Newton's equation, is equal to the force. And the force has two terms, there's a gravitational force and a pressure force. So let's write down the pressure force first. The pressure force is 1 over density times gradient of the pressure. So that's the microphysical force. And then there's the gravitational force, which is the gradient of phi. So this is just Newton's equation, Newton's force equation. However, it has a fancy name. It's called the Euler equation. And then the gravitational potential is induced by the matter. So there's the Newtonian gravity equation, which is a Poisson equation. Del square phi equals 4 pi g rho. So that's Newtonian gravity. So you have Newtonian mechanics, Newtonian gravity, mass conservation. And then you have, in addition, entropy conservation. So that's entropy conservation. So second law of thermodynamics. And then the fluid is described by an equation of state. Just a second. So for a specific fluid, the pressure will depend in a certain way on the energy density, and it may depend on the entropy. So that kind of completes the second conclusion.
That answers the specific entropy then per molecule or something like that, as opposed to the entropy per unit volume, spatial volume.
No, it's the entropy this is the entropy density.
But then don't you want the divergence of Vs rather than V dot del S in the conservation law? Just compare it with the mass conservation equation.
This says that the total derivative that's equivalent.
I mean, suppose that the fluid just expanded, then the entropy adiabatically, then the entropy density would go down.
That's right.
So the total derivative wouldn't be zero, like the world line. This is sort of the entropy per fluid element or something like that.
No, if I do your calculation, if I use the Hubble flow for V, then I will get d by dt s equals zero. I think this is okay. But I'm not very good at hydrodynamics, so I don't want to be hung up on this equation.
It's probably the conservation per co-moving volume.
Yes, per co-moving,
yeah. Yeah.
Sorry,
but fluid
element.
But see, here I'm doing
perturbations. Sometimes call it.
See, here I'm doing perturbations off of Minkowski. Right. So, and we'll come to. So these are the basic equations. So now, the next step is to specify the background. And now if we imagine matter in a universe, then obviously the background equations will not be satisfied if we have matter and we try to have non-expanding space.
So the continuity equation, is that meant to be the divergence of Brody?
Yeah. Okay, so the background is specified by some background energy density, which is constant because pressure, zero velocity, and some constant entropy density, and some constant gravitational potential. So that's the background. And this background is inconsistent. Because with matter you get an expanding space. But to illustrate the way that one does perturbation theory, I will nevertheless just continue.
You see, when a constant, you mean time constant.
Well, space independent as well. Because we are expanding about a spatially homogeneous universe. So these are just numbers.
So does it satisfy the Poisson equation?
No, it doesn't. That's one point. So, but you see, the reason I'm doing it this way is that the equations are a little bit simpler than if I directly do Newtonian perturbations about Friedman, Robertson, and Walker. And so I'll do the simpler algebra here, and then I'll just give you the final answer for this. Because you already know what the change is going to be. The change is just going to be exponential instability becomes power instability. So, anyway, so perturbations we set rho equals rho zero plus delta rho, p equals p zero plus delta p, v is delta v, phi is phi 0 plus delta phi, and s is s 0 plus delta s. where now these quantities depend on x and t. So unsats for cosmological perturbations. Now what we do is we, the next steps, we insert this ansatz into the equation of motion. Then we linearize. Trivial steps. I will do them on the board. And then what you do in the final step is you combine these two first order differential equations to get a second order differential equation. And you see, these three steps, you will do that for the Newtonian perturbation theory in Friedman, and you'll do it for the relativistic theory as well. In the relativistic theory, there are just some complications which I'll get. So,
Robert, sometimes people talk about hydrodynamical matter.
That this is hydrodynamical matter.
This is okay.
Hydrodynamical matter, single fluid. So, after doing these steps, we end up with d squared by dt squared delta rho minus, one more thing. Which I forgot, is, so I'll have to add one equation here. So the pressure depends on the energy density and on the entropy. And that means that delta P will be a function of delta rho and delta S. And the coefficients are defined as Cs squared and as sigma. So if the pressure is a function of rho and s, then the perturbation of the pressure depends on delta rho and delta s. The coefficients are defined this way. That defines Cs squared, speed of sound, and sigma. So, anyway, now after these three steps, you get a second order differential equation. And you get an equation. And these equations are put in the box. Because I want to discuss the physics. So first of all, going back to what I said at the very beginning, the preview, you see acceleration is induced by gravity, self-gravity. Self, if it were not for this term and for this term, you would see self-gravity gives you exponential instability. This is a correction that comes from the fact that there are pressure. If there's no pressure, this term vanishes. So I think I can eliminate the basic equations. So what I want to do now is I want to discuss the result. And these are linear equations, so all Fourier modes evolve independently. So in Fourier space, equations look like this. And so, first of all, classification. We have adiabatic perturbations. These are perturbations where there's no entropy perturbation. And entropy perturbations, delta S not equal to zero. So now what you see, observations. So the first thing is that entropy perturbations do not grow. Adiabatic perturbations they have an interesting time dependence. So they can grow or they oscillate depending on what the wavelength is. And entropy perturbations induce adiabatic perturbations. So if you start out with your initial conditions being a pure entropy perturbation, for example, you have a homogeneous universe, you go through a phase transition, you produce topological defects in a surrounding radiation bath. That's how you generate a pure entropy perturbation initially. This entropy perturbation will immediately start to induce an adiabatic mode via this equation. So, entropy perturbations. Source, an adiabatic.
Why wasn't that enough? I know it's out of context, but why wasn't that enough, therefore, to then harden their topological defects if they eventually meet the adiabatic perturbations? What's the results of inflation rate, which is adiabatic perturbation?
That question I won't answer yet. I have the answer.
Okay.
But that's a.
Professor.
I'll talk about that later. That's an excellent question. Now, actually, I can't explain it now. So, the key thing is that if you have an entropy perturbation around, delta rho will continue to grow, even on large scales. So when perturbations enter the Hubble radius, primordial adiabatic perturbations enter the Hubble radius with rho dot equals delta rho dot equals zero. Whereas due to this source term, something that was initially an entropy perturbation will enter the Hubble radius even when it's a density perturbation, it will enter with rho dot, delta rho dot, not equal to zero. That has that completely changes the location of the acoustic peaks. So that's why.
I don't understand why these observations hold. Is there
okay? Entropy perturbations do not grow. That's just this statement. Mm-hmm. Now, adiabatic perturbations, they have an interesting time dependence. Well, let's forget about entropy perturbations right now. It satisfies the second order differential equation. It has a growing solution if this term is not there. If this term dominates, it's oscillating. So, delta rho is not constant in time. And entropy perturbations source the adiabatic mode. If delta S is initially non-vanishing, then even if delta rho initially vanishes, at a later time, you won't vanish. So you're happy?
More so.
Okay, so that's crucial because all of these conclusions will be true for Newtonian perturbations, Robertson Walk, and in the relativistic theory. That's why I want to focus on that.
When you say pure entropy, that just means delta rho is zero and delta S is the only non-zero.
That's right. Okay, so then there's also a critical scale, namely the Jeans scale. And the Jeans scale distinguishes between wavelengths for which this term dominates compared to this term and scales where this term dominates. If you look at long wavelengths, k very small, this term dominates, and then you have exponential growth of fluctuations. Short wavelengths, large k, this term dominates, and then you have oscillations. So the critical scale is just given by this coefficient equals this coefficient. Kj equals 4 pi g rho 0 divided by Cs squared to the 1/2. That's a Jean scale, the inverse of it is a Jean's length. And you see that if long wavelengths, k smaller than kj, you have exponential growth. Of delta rho, whereas short k larger than kj, short wavelengths, you have oscillations. And you see that the oscillation frequency is given by the speed of sound. Cs. And finally, it's important to see that Kj depends on the type of matter. So if we consider radiation, P equals 1/3 rho, then you see that Cs squared is essentially unity. Kj is small, and Kj is approximately given by the Hubble scale, because this determines the Hubble scale.
Sorry, what was the W?
Omega k.
Omega.
Frequency. So for radiation, if matter is radiative, then fluctuations on scales smaller than the Hubble radius oscillate. Fluctuations on scales larger than the Hubble radius, they grow. Now, there are factors of pi and of 1, which I'm neglecting. So actually, the Jean's length is smaller than the Hubble scale. But if you have cold, dark matter, you have pressure is zero, Cs squared is zero, and therefore Kj is infinity. And therefore fluctuations at all wavelengths grow. So in terms of late time cosmology, it is crucial, makes a crucial difference whether the universe is dominated by radiation or dominated by cold dark matter. A cold dark matter model is much more unstable than the radiated model.
What happens to cosmos?
Well, we're not talking about that. That's if the cosmological constant is indeed here today and just visible today, it was unimportant. And if it is constant, time independent, it was unimportant that all scales were relevant for structure formation. Therefore, we neglect it. Okay, so now I would like this to be absolutely clear. All of these points, because that's the crucial physics, which we've kind of developed in this Newtonian theory about Minkowski space-time, but the basic conclusions will hold in a broader context. So, is everyone happy? Good. So now we can move on to Newtonian theory about FRW. Okay, so I want to renounce this system. So now what we will have is background. These background quantities are now going to be time dependent, as described by the Friedman equations. They're still space independent. And V0 is just the Hubble flow. That's the unperturbed velocity. I'm working in physical coordinates, the same coordinates in terms of which the equations of motion were written down. So now I have a consistent background. So now I introduce perturbations. And I'm interested in fractional perturbations. So rho of x and t. I call rho naught of t. Minus 1 plus delta epsilon. V of x and t is V naught plus delta V of x and t. So this V naught is just the Hubble flow. And P of x and t is T naught of t plus Cs square delta rho of x and t plus sigma delta s. So this is the perturbative ansatz. And the only point which I want to stress here is that we want to express the perturbations in terms of fractional perturbations, because we are interested in relative density perturbations.
Why does one use different symbols and rho and f? It's just a...
You don't need to. That's... It goes back to the fact that I usually work with rho. One usually works with rho in the West. But in the Soviet Union, one works with epsilon. My collaborator is Slava Ukanov. So it's a merger. It's a merger of notations. It's nothing.
Such a point.
No, nothing. Yeah. So now, what you do is you have this background, you have these perturbations, you stick this ansatz into the same hydrodynamic equations which I had before. And the only new step is that the equations simplify if you express them in terms of co-moving coordinates. Where x of t is a of t times q.
Robert, does it mean that Andre Linde is a traitor because now he doesn't use epsilon? Not use epsilon.
But he doesn't usually work on perturbations. Okay. So now, what will happen? And so it's not surprising that the equations look simple in co-moving coordinates, because it's in co-moving coordinates that the matter particles are at rest. So this is like it. So anyway, now there are going to be some steps of algebra, not just two, but in this time four, because you have to do this conversion. And then you will get equations which are comparable to these. And so let me just write down the answer. acceleration term. No, I won't do that. I will actually. Dots mean partial time derivative. So now you see that this quantity here this is just gradient with respect to x squared. So let's look at this equation. This is the new term, the Hubble friction term. But apart from this term, you have exactly the same terms as you had for Newtonian perturbations of Minkowski spacetime. So the acceleration, the second derivative of the density contrast, grows if the self-gravity term is dominant. There's a friction term, which means that the growth is not going to be exponential, but it's going to be power law. On small scales, the fluctuations are going to oscillate. Small scale means this larger than this. And again, entropy perturbations induce adiabatic perturbations. So we can speak about adiabatic perturbations and entropy perturbations. Just a second. Entropy perturbations do not grow. Adiabatic perturbations have interesting time dependence. Entropy perturbations source adiabatic perturbations. And all is still true. There's a distinguished scale, the gene scale. In physical coordinates, the gene scale is given by exactly the same expression as in Newtonian theory. If you're on scales larger, length scales larger than the gene scale, you get power law growth. If you're on length scales smaller than the gene's length, you get oscillations, but these are damped oscillations. So bottom line is that the physics is the same, the only crucial difference is somewhere.
The last density perturbation on the left hand side, is that still a fractional delta sub epsilon?
That's it.
Well, is there a physical reason why in both cases entropy perturbations just don't grow?
Because there's no physics in this simple hydrodynamical model that gives you the energy transfer from one component to the other. That's, I'm doing one fluid. You need interactions of fluids. Or of matter fields, you want to get blown into the perturbations. Like if you have a phase transition, then you dump matter from the field that undergoes the phase transition to radiation and two fluids expand. Okay. So now, what I want to do is I want to do an application of this. And this application will give, well, as a consequence of me doing this application, you should be more convinced that there is some cold dark matter in the universe. Because, just a reminder, in 1995, the dogma was omega in cold dark matter. That's the energy density in cold dark matter divided by the energy density for spatially flat universe. That was 0.95. That was a dogma in 1995. And omega baryon was 0.05. Now the year 2000 dogma is omega in CDM about 0.25, omega in baryon 0.05, and there's omega in lambda, which is 0.7. So now extrapolate to 2005, omega CDM equals 0, omega in lambda 0.95, omega baryon equals 0.05. That is not going to happen. I'm going to argue why. So.
Is that a bet?
Well, that would be a bet. So by cold dark matter, I just mean some stuff that behaves as no pressure. So what I want to do is I want to compare two universes. Time, and here I will plot. I want to take a universe A, which has omega cold dark matter equals 0.95, omega baryon equals 0.05, and log B, this is baryon plus radiation. Today, the amount of microwave radiation is tiny, even compared to the omega and baryon, but I have to include radiation. Mod B is omega CDM equals 0, omega B equals 1. So I want to compare how delta epsilon grows as a function of time. What I want to do is I want to start today. I want to consider a scale which is 8 megaparsecs. 8 million parsecs, 24 million light years. That's a scale of clusters of galaxies. That's a scale where we today observe the fractional density perturbation from the order 1. So I want to work backwards to the time of equal matter and radiation, and then backwards to the time of, time of recombination, and then time of equal matter and radiation. So,
is the time sequence of T equal matter and radiation and time recombination the same for the two universes?
It's... yes. It's the same. If you compare an open universe and a flat universe, you get different time sequences. But if you have matter components with the same equation of state at late times, you have exactly the same sequence. So in order to answer your question, what I've used the fact that both baryons and CDM during this entire time period are pressureless. That means that the time scale evolution is the same. Okay, now one thing which I forgot to say, which I leave as an exercise, is take a matter-dominated universe today with no entropy perturbations. Take pressureless matter, no term, solve this second order differential equation, and you find that delta epsilon grows as t to the 2/3, which is scale factor. That is Cs squared equals square. Actually, I should write that down as results. So. Results. So if you just solve this equation, and the results are 4 delta s equals 0. So if you look at long wavelengths, you find delta epsilon grows as the scale factor. And short wavelengths, you find that delta epsilon decays as the square root of the scale factor, and it's positive. So that follows immediately from this equation. Okay, so I work backwards. I take universe A and universe B. This is my B universe. Work backwards to the time of recombination. Cosmological evolution is the same because the equation of state is the same. Cs squared is equal to 0 for the dominant component. Now, what happens in model A? Cold dark matter. Cold dark matter doesn't couple to radiation. So, between ecomatter and radiation and recombination, delta epsilon also scales as the scale factor. However, baryons before recombination were coupled to the radiation. The radiation has an equation of state p equals 1/3. Therefore, small scales, like cluster scales, they are in the phase where you have damped oscillations. So you find that in model A, in model B, the delta epsilon in model B at the time of equilibrium radiation, that this is much larger and it's larger by a factor of 3/2 powers of the scale factor at recombination divided by the scale factor of equilibrium radiation compared to delta epsilon in model A. And this factor is about 30. Now it's delta epsilon at T equality, which governs the temperature anisotropies, which are measured today. So you find that in model B, without cold dark matter, the temperature anisotropies are predicted to be a factor of 30 larger than in model A. And if you work If you take into account the factors of ordinality, you find that in model B, the microwave anisotropies are predicted to be about 10 to the minus 3. Whereas in model A, they're predicted to be 3 times 10 to the minus 5. Now, if you look back at the first paper, the paper by Sachs and Wolf on microwave anisotropies, which were written in the late 60s, 67, 68, before people knew about cold dark matter. In that paper, Sachs and Wolf did exactly this calculation in model B, and they predicted that one should have microwave anisotropies of fractional magnitude 10 to the minus 3. 10 to the minus 3 seemed a feasible goal in 1970 for experimental cosmologists, whereas 10 to the minus 5 would never have been perceived as a feasible goal Therefore, experimental cosmologists started looking for light-wave ensembles. Slowly, they built up the accuracy. 10 years after they started, they reached accuracy 10 to the minus 3. They found a dipole, but that's all motion. They worked harder, 10 to the minus 4. Then they knew that there had to be something besides baryons. They didn't find anything. By 1990, they got worried because they had reached a few times 10 to the minus 5, and they still hadn't found anything. But 1992, they found something, 10 to the minus 5. So the fact that the microwave anisotropies are a few times 10 to the minus 5 and not 10 to the minus 3, to me, that's the strongest indication that there is quantum mechanics. Otherwise, there would be an inconsistency between the matter power spectrum that's observed in galaxies and microwave anisotropies. And so you see this comes out as a simple application of these fluctuations. Okay. So now I've noticed that the questions are decreasing. Does that mean that the audience has worn out its energy for today? Because this is kind of a point where it's a point where I could break. Because next step is classical relativistic perturbations. So maybe I should break here. Does that sound good?
Yes,
okay. Now, one last thing. Next week, could we have this lecture on Wednesday instead of Tuesday? Is that possible?
Well, we have 2 to 3 and 4 to 5.
Well, right now there is no post-seminar.
Oh, there isn't. Oh.
Nothing scheduled.
And you don't anticipate one?
And I don't anticipate one. Next 2 days, just for next week. So
should we?
So from the university perspective, it will work. From the perimeter perspective, it will work too.
It will work. Yeah.
Okay.
3:30.
Any time in the afternoon is fine. Things as default 3:30.
Default is 4.
No, default for this sequence.
Ah.
Yeah. If you make it 4, it looks like a picot, though. Some people would be surprised.
Yeah, the seminar of 2 o'clock is a long seminar. It may
right.
just end at 3:30.
Yeah.
Anyway, you
but
decide.
In that,
so we'll
say 3:30, and then if the other one goes too long, you can always start a little bit late.
Right, so next Wednesday.
Okay.
3:30.